Hello and welcome to Gonservation Conversations, the show that travels far and wide to bring you the best in nature. And this week we haven't travelled far at all, as I've been joined at home by someone who is practically a neighbour. Conservationist, co-founder of the famous Bird Fair, who has launched a new global bird fair, and former reserve manager at Rutland Water. Good morning, Tim Appleton.
Kerry, it's absolutely brilliant to be here. And I mean, we've just experienced the most weirdest weather. You know, I came over in the snow. It's in sunshine now. It's April tomorrow. I did wake up this morning wondering whether it was April the 1st. The snow was something really weird. But hey ho, here we are. And it's just great to be with you again after a lot of association with different areas of the bird fair you've been involved in the past. And hopefully again this year with the Global Bird Fair in July. So really looking forward to working with you.
Absolutely. I can't wait to get working on things again. I mean, that's the thing. We have come out of the whole COVID pandemic period, and for a lot of things, we haven't been able to work together. We haven't been able to get on with projects that we've been working on. Is there a feeling that with lost time that you just want to get on with stuff now?
Well, in a way, yes, but I also would like to take you back about 18 months ago when we launched a thing called Global Birding, because suddenly there was everyone stuck in their homes, watching wildlife from their balconies, and creeping down to the shops or whatever it might be, to actually watch and look and suddenly discover this thing called nature. So here was this wonderful opportunity to try to bring people together using the likes of eBird, the Cornell University that conducts these wonderful citizen science projects where people can record birds that they see. It doesn't have to be a rare bird, it can be anything, but it's all part of gathering information. So I thought, well, how can we actually extend this to involve people who are suddenly discovering nature for the first time? There's no cars around, so they were hearing, what's this weird singing thing? Oh, it's a blackbird. Oh, that's what they do. Of course, the blackbirds have in the past had to sing much louder so that they could be heard above the traffic. So here I was thinking, how can we bring people together? I work very closely with BirdLife International and have done for many, many years. In fact, I think we can claim we've raised £40 million for BirdLife and the various conservation projects around the world. And I wanted to continue doing something, working with them and working closely with Swarovski Optics, who have been wonderful in terms of supporting conservation. And I'm actually on their birding council, which is really helpful. So I came up with this idea. There's this event called Global Big Day, which eBird have been doing for several years, but they also have another period in the autumn where they call Global Big Day, October Big Day. But I wanted to make it slightly longer, so I called it Global Bird Weekend. I then put out with Penny, my partner, we went out to every corner of social media we could. We grabbed people almost, you know, from their armchairs as they were sort of watching EastEnders or whatever it might be. And suddenly there was this sort of community coming together thinking, oh, it'd be wonderful because I could actually go out and watch the birds in my park and maybe even form a team. And suddenly we went from nothing to over 180 countries globally taking part in a one-day event, which we've extended over 2 days, and bringing people together. It's just wonderful. We have people literally from Russia to China to Liberia to Libya, all over South America, and they formed as teams, or they came in as individuals. And I think we broke about 4 world records, you know, but it wasn't the world records we were after. It's great that, you know, we could provide those sort of information. But it was a way of just bringing people together because we encourage, you know, people who are good wildlife watchers to actually grab their neighbour and take them out, introduce them to the common birds. But of course, once you start doing this sort of thing, it expands, and then we were able to raise money for a conservation project. So we've now held 2 of these events. The third one is coming up on the 14th of May this year. So really looking forward to it.
Well, but there's 2 things I'd like to discuss. When you talk about world records, what kind of world records were they?
Well, this was firstly the number of people that went out on a single day. At one point, I think we had something like 51,000 people actually out with their binoculars. You know, I mean, some of the people were literally watching the birds from their balcony because they were confined through the pandemic. They weren't allowed to sort of leave the house, you know, unless they go shopping or whatever it might be they need to do for essentials. But so that was extraordinary. It also beat the world record on the number of sightings seen in a single day. Over 100,000 records were sent to BirdLife. eBird. But the most important one, I guess, was the fact that over 7,200 species of birds, bear in mind there's 10,500 or so in the world, were seen again on a single day. And I mean, that's wonderful, isn't it? That, you know, you've got people going out, and of course, bear in mind at the time, they had to be fairly restrictive. And I think what I've tried to do right from the beginning was to encourage people not to travel, particularly, you know, at this time, we didn't want people sort of going out into the countryside and, you know, spreading germs and COVID or whatever it might be. But we really wanted people to just enjoy what they can see in their own communities and bring their communities together. So that was the sort of world records we were beating. And that will continue because we're now, the last event we had was in October last year. We had 195 countries actually taking part. So our goal this year will be to get the 200th country. And interestingly, in October, the billionth record was sent in to eBird on the first day of the weekend, which is a milestone. It was extraordinary. That was, a water hen somewhere in New Zealand that was reported. So, yeah, it's been brilliant. And, you know, but it's the bringing together of people that, and without pressure to do this, if they want to raise a bit of money, they can do it. But it's more to do with, you know, engaging communities. And now we've set up this sort of social networking and people chatting to each other from, you know, Liberia to Libya to London to where else is there in London, begin with L or whatever.
Leeds.
Oh, Leeds. I'm sure there will be, without doubt, there will be people in Leeds doing it as well.
So do you think COVID, in its own weird way, even though everyone became disunited, in another way, we're able to unite in things together in a way that perhaps we could never have seen possible? And do you worry that this unity that you've created with the projects you've been working on could dissipate as we get further away from the pandemic?
There's always a chance that could happen. But I think so many people have now found nature, you know, in lots of different ways, that I don't think they'll let it go. I think they've realised that, you know, there is something better than sitting down and watching TV or whatever it might be. You know, get out, it's healthier. People are much more conscious of their mental health, and they realise the value of being in nature. It's better all around for people. And I think we can maintain that. And one of the reasons I've tried to keep the new Global Bird Fair going is to introduce people to the commercial side, which I'm, you know, very aware of. If anything, I'm slightly different than most reserve managers. I do have a slight entrepreneurial streak somewhere down me, but it's all leading to a better understanding of conservation, a better understanding of what people can do for nature, and at the same time helping the commercial industry. Because, I mean, you know, if people don't go out and buy binoculars, or they don't go out and we'll probably come on to this, you know, take a nature tourism holiday, then there's massive implications, I believe, for conservation, particularly in a lot of these critically endangered habitats around the world that people would want to go to. And of course, you know, one of the things we will want to discuss, I suspect, at some stage, is the fact that, you know, a lot of people say air travel, you shouldn't do it, it's absolutely against everything that we believe in. Well, I personally think that's absolutely rubbish, and I'll probably be slammed for doing that. But I'm very conscious that an awful lot of people in communities around the world over these last 2 years, as a result of the pandemic, were not receiving tourism guests in terms of the nature tourism. And these are people that totally rely on it. You know, they're bird guides. They're people that clean lodges. They're people that drive the taxis to take the guests around, you know. And as a result, what are they doing? They're having to go out and feed themselves. Well, what do you do that? You cut down more forest. You know, you put more cattle into the forest and you lose the habitat. And there's great evidence already. And one of the people that we're going to have at Bird Fair is John Bruno, who is the chief executive of the Ecotourism Conservation Organization based in the States, but they've got 15,000 members, and he's very supportive and very conscious of the fact that air travel at the level that our nature tourists do is playing virtually no impact. What do you do? Do you actually decide, okay, we'll cut the forest down and we'll build lots of hotels and 20,000 people fly out? Or do you leave the forest, support the local community, and 100 people go out and to that and enjoy it, and the wildlife stays there for future generations? It's a massive question that some people that completely knock all forms of travel must really ask themselves, you know.
Is it not just a balancing act?
Totally. Couldn't agree more. But a lot of people don't see that balancing act. And I think that's where I hope I can take people and make them understand that we do need some form of travel. You know, I would love to just sit at home and think that everything's going to be hunky-dory in Ecuador or Peru or, you know, wherever in Africa or whatever. It's not real, I'm afraid. We have got to get people to enjoy, you know, that wildlife. Some people might say it's very privileged that you can get on a plane and you get picked up and you have wonderful lodges. But just think the whole thing through. Look at those people that are supporting the tourists as they arrive, because, you know, they are supporting the conservation.
Well, look, we will talk more on these subjects throughout this chat we're going to have. What I wanted to do was take you back in time, because I always find it fascinating speaking to somebody like you who has been at the forefront of conservation for years and years. There must have been a moment where you weren't into it and that you moved into conservation. How did you get into conservation, and why did it, and how did it become your life?
Well, I'm afraid I've been into conservation of some form or other since I was probably about 4 years old. I lived in Bristol on a actually only 4 miles from the centre, but we lived on the edge of a golf course with huge woods. Anyone who knows, it's called Blaze Woods, absolutely amazing area. So I was one of these horrible little children that would be, you know, out in the garden, probably looking for bird eggs, and which I, of course, I had a little collection in those days, which was quite legal. Well, probably was legal, illegal, anyway, whatever. And, you know, I used to sort of just enjoy everything around me. I remember finding a nightjar's nest in the lane, 3.5 miles from the centre of Bristol. Now, can you imagine that now? And that was probably back in the early 60s. Oh dear, I've given away my age now. Yeah, I mean, I kept, you know, mice and hamsters and all sorts of things. And we had, you know, I kept bantam. So I was always surrounded. And I loved being out in the woods, and I used to make dens and just being out there. So, and then I went to school, and, you know, I used to have a garden. I was a boarder at a school in Wells in Somerset. Then I did biology and zoology at A level, but I started, they started in those days in the mid 60s, there were quite a lot of these wildlife parks getting established, and there was a wonderful one called Westbury Wildlife Park. And so I went down there as a volunteer and just used to help out. And I forgot that I ought to really go to university, which I didn't, I never did. So I just kept on working there, met lots of interesting people. And one of my loves has always been wildfowl, ducks and geese and swans. And I met many of the staff from Slimbridge. And I used to get taken up by mum and dad to be dumped at Slimbridge while they went shopping in Gloucester or wherever. And so I always wanted a passion to work with Peter Scott. So from the wildlife park, I then managed to get a job basically murdering deer as a deer verderer at Woburn Abbey, working for the Duke and Duchess of Bedford, which was, again, a learning curve. But in the meantime, I was in touch with Peter Scott's private secretary, who got on really well with, and he was alerting me to any job that might come up at Slimbridge. Well, within a few months, a job did come up, not at Slimbridge, but a place called Peacock, which is near Peterborough. And so I cut my teeth there. I think they put me on, they really tested me, because I remember spending 3 months painting creosoted fences and things like that. I stuck to it, and within another 6 months, I was promoted to the deputy creator at Slimbridge over people who had been there for years. And there was a chap coming down, only about 24, 25 at the time. Anyway, I got on really well with Peter Scott, and he could see the potential, I guess, and he sort of helped me then move on when I got my new job at Rutland Water, and I've been there ever since. And of course, the great thing about Rutland Water was that I could use the knowledge I gained from Slimbridge and other places in terms of habitat management and habitat creation, which had never been done on the scale I was about to attempt at Rutland.
I'd love to just go back a little bit there and talk about Peter Scott, because for a lot of our listeners, they may not know who Peter Scott was, why he was important, but how important was he for you, and what kind of conversations and what kind of knowledge did you glean from him?
Oh, I mean, Peter was, has been my absolute mentor right from, you know, day one. The thing that I know and I've learned more than anything was probably that Peter always put people first before wildlife. He always said that once you get people hooked on wildlife, they'll love it. Show them things, but at the same time, you've got to get people. And that's why Slimbridge and Peacock and Arundel and Washington, all these centres, Martin Mir, have been, I believe, very successful in basically, I guess, educating people, you know, inspiring people. And Peter was brilliant. I mean, what was lovely about him, you know, there was this Sir Peter Scott, globally known at the time, the founder of the, or co-founder of the WWF, World Wide Fund for Nature, but at the same time, an extraordinarily interesting man. I mean, I spent many times on the Dumbles, which is the wild area around Slimbridge, just with him in the hides. And Phil, his wife, used to come in every now and again, haul him out by the short and curlies and say, Peter, come on, we're out, there's no money in the bank, you need to go and paint. So he'd paint for 5 days and then he'd be back in the hide again. I mean, he was just that sort of person. And everyone called him Peter. Everyone, he called everybody by their Christian name. He was very inspiring in every way. And in fact, sadly, when he died, I was hoping he would open our new centre at our first birdwatching centre at the Bruton Water. But in the end, Phil, Lady Scott, of course, came and opened it. So we maintained that relationship.
And how important do you think his legacy is today?
Oh, that's massive. I mean, absolutely extraordinary. I mean, you know, just set aside, you know, if you like, the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, or as it is now WWT. I mean, you know, look at the work they do in internationally. You know, it's not just Slimbridge. You know, it's not just a duck zoo. You know, they're doing a massive amount of work all over the world, you know, working on wetlands and basically doing some fantastic work. But also, of course, WWF. I mean, look at what that has done. So, yeah, no, he's been incredible, and I have a very poor painting of his, which is actually it's about half the size of his normal painting, and I just look at that every day and think, Peter, you were quite amazing.
And did you ever go out with him? Did you take trips with him? Did he mentor you? It just from the office, or did you work with him on the ground?
Oh, totally on the grounds, absolutely. It's interesting, just recently, I never went on a trip outside, if you like, of the grounds. But, I mean, that's what I say, we'd be in a hide together, just watching in those days on the Dumbles, the geese coming in the winter months. But I used to go in the house a lot, because as deputy curator, you know, obviously, and Mike Lubbock, who was then the curator, was away a huge amount of time. So I was basically running Slimbridge for, you know, most of the year, when Mike, you know, was collecting duck eggs from Mongolia or wherever it might be. So, yes, I mean, it was a very close relationship, and it was very exciting. And, in fact, just recently I had to go down to Slimbridge because I was invited to give a talk on the nenes, because I was very much involved in the Hawaiian goose restoration project in the sort of early, in the 70s. And I was invited to go out to Hawaii to give a talk about that. And so I went down and took some various pictures. And so I think it was a lovely one of me standing next to the statue of Peter in the grounds, you know, just sort of smiling up and saying, you know, well done, Peter. Thanks for inspiring me. I went round the house again, and it was just lovely because that is now available to people to actually rent out. You know, they can go there for the evening. But it was just lovely to sort of go there quietly, you know, with Penny and just sort of think, oh, I remember sitting there or chatting to him there. And it's just lovely. He's a great man. Absolutely wonderful.
You have a love of wildfowl, I guess.
Yes. Very boring, really. But no, I mean, that's what I'm trying to do, is to see all the world's wild, you know, ducks, geese and swans. And I've got about 13 left to see, but they're all in remote parts of the world. Or, I mean, the most frustrating thing was the Madagascar pochard, which was thought to be extinct. And I mopped up in Madagascar, saw that, and about 2 years later, some damn person found the bloody bird again. So now, which is absolutely amazing, isn't it, that, you know, something that was thought to be extinct has, you know, is about, you know, has actually been found again. So I've actually seen them now in Slimbridge, where they're doing a rehabilitation project and you know, breeding them on, as well as breeding them in the wild, I would say, as well. So I've got to go back to Madagascar. So I can think of worse things to do, can't you?
Absolutely. But there is something about seeing a bird in its natural environment that yes, you can see birds in rehabilitation programs and them being raised for conservation purposes, But seeing something where it belongs is intrinsically the greatest thrill.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, and that's why I love wetlands, because, I mean, it's not just the, you know, the ducks, if you like. It's everything that you see in a wetland, you know, whether it's the okavango and the elephants walking across the wetlands and up goes a snipe or whatever it might be. It's just they are the most remarkable habitats and so pristine when they are kept in good condition. Of course, so many are threatened and have been drained. In fact, I'll mention this now, our project for this year at Global Birding is trying to restore La Janda in southern Spain, which, of course, you're familiar with Spain. And so we're trying to get that restored. Maybe we'll talk about that later on. But, I mean, potentially that was the largest lake in Europe and a critical stopping-off point for birds migrating backwards and forwards from northern Europe into Africa. So that's my project this year. You know, it's, and I did another one a couple of years ago in Argentina, in a place called Marquechita. And it's now been designated, the money we used, working with Aves Argentina and the local communities in Cordoba, they're now just announcing the largest national park for the whole of Argentina, which is going to be Marquechita. So a little feather in our cap there as well. So there's all sorts of wonderful things that, you know, you start something off and you give them the money or whatever, and, you know, enthusiasm. I've been out there a couple of times and just, you know, met lots of lovely people. And
I hope the feather in your cap has been found on the ground and you haven't been plucking it from rare species.
Well, yes. No. I do have a condor's feather, which is about 3 feet long, which I found on the ground, but I thought, well, you know, hopefully it shed the feather rather than was shot. No, but no, absolutely. But it's been a massive honour to go to lots of places, you know, we've supported, and you know, but, you know, we're careful. You know, we make sure that, you know, if we are going somewhere, or I'm going somewhere, then, you know, I'm going there for a purpose and not just sort of having a jolly.
So with La Janda, why is this in need of support?
Well, I mean, basically, we've got to go back to the 50s when Franco drained the lake and handed illegally, I should say, because it was public land, and handed it over to all his sort of mates, for want of a better word. And, of course, then it, you know, got turned into agriculture, whether it's rice fields or whatever. And so, basically, there's a group, the Amigos de La Janda, trying to get this restored, working with SEO, the BirdLife partner, and with other individuals to try to slowly buy land back or get it back legally by going into the courts. And so we're going to be looking at ways in which, you know, we're not going to raise a huge amount of money, but we're going to expose the public to this amazing area of Andalusia. And hopefully, you know, bit by bit, we'll get it restored. And, you know, that will have, say, massive benefits for the birds from Britain. You know, the swallow that's on its way over at the moment from Africa will, you know, have somewhere to feed, stock up a little bit before it makes the last bit of journey to the UK or wherever else in Europe, and vice versa in the autumn when they're leaving us with their broods of young and, you know, they need to feed somewhere on the way back before they make the crossing into the over the Sahara and the Mediterranean. So, yeah, it's a critical area. But, of course, it's not just there. There's lots of local people in Spain will be absolutely, you know, enthralled by the area. You know, it's great for us and it'll be great for the Spaniards as well.
Well, we will do everything we can to support. I can almost feel a Gonservation Conversation special coming up. Yeah. And talk to all the relevant parties about this. But moving on, one last question about wildfowl. I just wanted to talk to you. Pink-headed duck.
Oh, that's cruel. That's cruel. Well, I mean, I spent two expeditions in Myanmar, Burma, with colleague Jonathan Eames, and to see whether we could find this bird that hasn't been really seen properly, we know, since the mid-30s. And I was convinced that, you know, we had every chance of seeing this. Part of the country has been out of bounds because of, you know, political reasons. And we got permission to go to a lot of places that other people haven't been to, again, for years. Some fantastic habitat. And on about the fourth day of actually on our first expedition, we were at Indira Lake, which is a massive, massive area, huge, huge area. And we were just watching, you know, didn't have telescope up or anything like that, did have binoculars. And suddenly, way over on the right, we spotted a big group of duck getting up. I think they were mainly spot-billed ducks. But one duck just stood out to all of us. What have we got here? You know, you can imagine the excitement. And this, a pink-headed duck flew within about 200 metres of us, turned independently from the group, and then went down into this huge, huge reed bed. And that was it. We were ecstatic. We were over the moon. We just couldn't believe our luck. But then, of course, for some people, you start creeping, well, did we see it, or is this just our imagination? I know what I saw. I saw a pink-headed duck. I can't prove it. I've got no evidence. We didn't have the cameras with us. So personally, I've got it on my bird list. I'm possibly the only person in the world alive still that's got it on his bird list. If I saw it, you know, does it matter to anybody else? I know what I saw. I enjoyed it. I only hope that a guy called Richard Thorns, who's doing an awful lot of work to try to rediscover it at the moment, you know, is successful. But again, the political situation in Myanmar is pretty dire, and a lot of access to the big main areas is very, very difficult. But he's looking at putting in cameras, track cameras, in areas that we think they could be existing. But it's possible they are extinct, but I think there's still hope. I really critically think there's still hope.
There's always hope, but at the same time, it also sums up the problem with our planet, doesn't it? That actually, we don't quite know what we've got anymore.
And again, I harp back to my nature tourism. If we keep these habitats alive and safe and secure for the future, then at least what we have now hopefully will be secure.
Okay, so I'm going to take us back through our meander through chronology, which jumps everywhere, to be honest. But you ended up in 1975 at Rutland Water. Now, how did that come about? What were you expecting to do? How long did you think you might be there? And what happened?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, the Wildlife Trust, the local Wildlife Trust, interviewed me. And I think I was quite lucky in that the experience I'd had, you know, with Peter Scott, and although several hundred people apparently applied for the job, I was given the job. And at the time, the Wildlife Trust was very, very small. And on the day I started, I drove up from Bristol, from Slimbridge, and went to the office in Leicester, expecting to be conducted across to this new nature reserve. And I was given an ordnance survey map and said, well, the rest is yours. It's extraordinary. So I went over to where I thought there would be some water. There was no water there whatsoever. The dam was still being constructed. But what was brilliant was that I could then start making relationships with the water company that obviously were building this, and with individuals in the area through the local natural history societies, and with the building people as well, the people who were, you know, the lorry drivers, and I'll come to that in a minute, why that was important. So the first thing I had to do was try to work out where the reserve was, because I knew it was going to be 9 miles long, the whole of the western end of the reservoir. I also had to deal with a lot of farmers who weren't desperately happy about the area, you know, that they had their sheep and their cattle and their corn and what have you, was going to go underwater. So that was quite a challenge to sort of keep everybody and get the balances right. So basically, I was literally on my own, with no assistant warden or anything like that. I had a dog and a tractor they gave me and something to bore a hole with in the back of it. And I used to go up and down these rows where I thought the trees were going to be. And I knew by then, the great thing actually the water company did was to actually mark out where the top water line would be. So that instantly helped me sort of say, well, okay, it's going to be there. I need to plant here. I need to do this. I need to build these paths. I need to think now where the hide's going to go. Oh, dear, we're facing east all the time, so I'm going to have to joint them, you know, mix them around a little bit. So I literally had a complete plain sheet in which to start. And it was extraordinary. I mean, it's never been, I don't think at that point anything had ever been done on this scale before. I planted about 100,000 trees in the first 2 or 3 years. I started getting local people helping. I worked with the local schools. We had groups coming out to help with the planting. Worked very closely with a lot of the lorry drivers who were taking materials away to dump and this was sort of buildings that were being demolished. I was saying, well, if you'd like to just dump it over there, it could form an island, and you know, put it over there. And then, of course, I had to think about the lagoons, because you know, we needed safe lagoons that would be outside of the recreation area. And so we built three lagoons, and they wanted, contractors wanted nice straight lines. I said, oh, no, 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 no. We need lovely curving lines. I want these little promontories to go out that would create duckling survival bays and that sort of stuff. And it's all worked. It's been absolutely brilliant. We wanted penstocks. We wanted to be able to control the water levels. And what on earth do you want to do that for? I said, well, you know, there are times when you need to lure the water. We want lovely muddy littoral zones for the waders that are going to come here and blah, 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 that sort of thing. And then the other key thing, which I think is probably the most critical thing, why the whole thing has been so successful, was the water company set up a thing called the Rutland Water Users Panel. And I was the only conservationist on it. It was made up of the farming community, the police, the sailors, the fishermen. And I was strong enough to say, right, we need to have zones where people can't sail, can't fish. And eventually we ended up with the whole of the 9 miles of the reservoir at the western end, which is the reserve. There's no bank fishing. The sailing limits were kept back by about 3/4 of a mile from the banks. Boat fishing is allowed into the areas, but they can't come within a certain distance of the lagoon banks. So we worked very closely, and I think that's really been very successful. And I think and of course, Rutland, as people may or may not know, is a major recreational area. 200,000 or 300,000 people cycle around it every year. You know, thousands of people sail on it, thousands of people fish in it. They've held the World Fly Fishing Championships. Our Olympic sailors use it for training, etc. So, you know, it is very much a multi-use. And I think where we've been so successful is we've been able to demonstrate to other potential developers of reservoirs, you can actually still have recreation, you can have nature, and at the end of the day, you're an industrial body. So this is why I think we've been very helpful, you know, very successful.
Does it not also show that if you create the right habitat, the creatures will come?
Oh, totally. The only thing we've ever introduced is a thing called an osprey. I don't know if you've heard of that. So basically, no, everything that I've planted, you know, the trees are the only things basically we introduced, you know. And it's quite extraordinary. Where did all these fish come from? I reckon there's 350 tons of quartz fish in that reservoir at the moment. And there are internationally large pike and, you know, all sorts of great animals. So I'm digressing a bit. But, you know, no, I mean, I tell you the other person that did help me, people may or may not have heard of him, was Dr. Harrison from the Seven Oaks Project. And he had done a mini Rutland Water on a gravel pit. So I spent 2 or 3 days down there with him showing, you know, looking at what he had done there. And that did help me enormously as well with sort of thinking about, you know, the concept of particularly the positioning of bird watching hides and things like that, and the nature trails. Because bear in mind, here was this wonderful area, but it's flat, and therefore how are you going to get people from A to B without disturbing? So, you know, I just planted thousands of willow trees, which we could then coppice on a rotation along the paths, and that's helped enormously.
Okay, so we did mention it just a moment ago, or you mentioned it, ospreys. How, why, what? Did it work?
Well, yes, certainly it did work. I mean, basically, it all stems back to a couple of days in 1996 when I looked out of the bedroom window and saw a one osprey sitting on the logs in the old fish ponds, which is part of the reservoir. 2 days later, again, a second bird appeared. And of course, oh, I thought, right, that's it, breeding pair, they'll come back next year. So we looked after them and, you know, we made sure they weren't disturbed. I think they're probably two males, which is not good for breeding pairs. And this was told to be quite clearly by Roy Dennis, who's probably one of the world's leading authorities on ospreys. So he came down and we contemplated and we looked at things and we thought, I wonder if there's any possibility of actually translocating ospreys, because the populations in Scotland were beginning to increase and there was a possibility we could do something very special here. But of course, you know, all these sort of things cost money and time and energy. But fortunately, the water company again came in and decided they would definitely support it financially. So Roy and I went across to Minnesota to look at a project, the only other project in the world where translocation of ospreys had been successful, where they disappeared from the lakes around Minneapolis through, again, DDT and all that sort of stuff, and through persecution. So they had brought ospreys down from Canada, and they were hacking them back, and so we learnt a huge amount, and they've been successful. So we basically replicated that at Rutland Water, brought chicks down for 5 years. Big job, because you have to, of course, you've got to get consent from Natural England, Scottish Natural Heritage, you know, to take birds, keep them in captivity, that sort of stuff. But it worked, and now, what, 25 years later, we've got lots of pairs breeding in the area. They're expanding out into other parts of Britain, into the Lake District, into Wales, further south. So, yeah, it's been highly popular. And again, it's inspiring people. You need an iconic species. You can just imagine that, can't you? You know, sitting in the hide, and then suddenly out of the sky plummets this bird, picks up a fish, takes it, shakes its feathers, and water splashes all over the place, and the fish is struggling underneath it, and it takes it to the nest, and you know, and I mean, what better way can you inspire somebody who's perhaps never seen an osprey or even a bird of prey before? So yeah, it's been brilliant. We get about 30,000 people every year to come down and see them, and yeah, it's been fantastic.
The other thing that has come out of your time at Rutland Water was the bird fair. I mean, that's now no longer going, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but the bird fair, I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. I mean, many people know that it's been termed the Glastonbury for birders. Yeah. But how did you come up with that? Is it true that this was one of those just inventions that appeared magically? And do let us know how that appeared.
Yeah, OK. Well, I mean, yeah, in a way, it's been magical. I mean, certainly the outcome's been amazing. But it stems back to the fact that back in 1985, I went to the Game Fair, which people won't necessarily know is a massive great fair for the outdoor countryside folk, you know, so for shooting and fishing and all that stuff. And I just couldn't believe the size of it. I thought, this is incredible, you know. But there was nothing for the birding industry. And this is, again, my entrepreneurial comes in. I'm thinking, well, how can I support the industry that is growing through the numbers of new members? For the RSPB, we're heading towards 1 million. The Wildlife Trust, we're heading towards 500,000 members. But where was it? They could go and find out about all the equipment we use, our binoculars, our holidays, our bird food, our cameras, or anything to do with the industry. Books, of course. So a colleague of mine, Martin Davies, and I got together. Martin and I had worked on quite a few little projects, you know, that I was already doing at Rutland. We did wildflower sales, we did painting exhibitions, we had Bruce Pearson coming down, and various other people. I was running the thing called the Bird Race that was done through several of the magazines, always had the prize giving there, and we then ran it for about three years doing the actual admin. I don't know how I managed to find the time to do that, thinking about it. But anyway, whatever. So we had a meeting in a pub called the Finch's Arms in the little village of Hamilton where I live. And we basically thought, well, you know, we could probably do this, but how do we actually get the business side of it? How do we get the manufacturers to think, you know, this is actually worth doing? So we worked with a company called InFocus, and Bruce Hansen, who's been absolutely amazing, has run InFocus for many, many years. And he then sort of thought, again, wow, this is amazing. He could see the possibilities. So he then contacted the likes of the Swarovskis and the Zeiss's and, you know, Leicas and things. Look, you know, there's a couple of weird guys up in the middle of nowhere thinking of doing a commercial event. They just loved it. They loved the idea. So it all stems literally from that sort of conversation. So we had a very, well, relatively small event. I think we started in 1989. At the time, Martin and I thought, wouldn't it be great if we can raise some money? So basically, we wanted three things. We wanted to build the businesses, the industry up. We wanted to give people the opportunity to network and just meet and meet old friends, make new friends. You know, or I was at that Twitch, whatever, in wherever. You know, do you remember seeing that such and such a bird? And, you know, wow, wasn't it great? And then we, of course, we really wanted to raise money for nature conservation. But the thing we didn't want to do, because, I mean, and this comes as much from me as anything, I felt that with all the conservation organisations that were so successful in the UK, surely the money that we could raise, if we raise any, would be better spent abroad. You know, the pound in wherever is going to do a lot more than the pound in, you know, in Britain. So, yeah, well, that was been our mantra right from the beginning. And that first year, we actually raised £3,000, which in 1989, you know, was quite good. We did it for the Stop the Massacre campaign. And again, people loved that, the idea, of course, you know, birds were being massacred in the Mediterranean, et cetera, et cetera. And then the following year, we did Doñana, and we raised £10,000. But at that point, we said, hang on, this is a lot of hard work for us to actually make sure the money is being spent properly, because, you know, here we were taking people's money from the visitors and giving it to a pot somewhere in Spain or wherever it might be. You know, was the money being spent, you know, properly? It was, actually, of course. But we thought, the way this is going, this could actually lead to a lot more money being raised. So that's when we brought in BirdLife International. And ever since then, we've raised, I think, 5.5 million on the site and given that away. And then BirdLife International have then used that to trigger a lot more money, up to 35 million. So basically, you know, if you've been to Bird Fair over the last 31 years, you have helped raise 40 million pounds of international conservation. And it's launched hundreds of companies. It's been probably the other thing that's impossible to actually ever put a figure on, a monetary figure on, is what it's done for networking. You know, the number of people that come just to meet, you know, an author or meet a company that they could perhaps, you know, guide for or whatever it might be. There's 101 things that go on behind my back, if you like, that, you know, I just get on and think, wow, isn't it great to see such wonderful people, shake a few hands and have a beer.
Well, you deserve it, because I know how much time goes into organising it. So, I mean, I've been there and I've been lucky enough to take part in events. And for me, it was one of the most inspiring moments of my life was when I listened to Margaret Atwood speak. And then I talked to her about conservation issues. And at that time, I was just more interested in making a documentary about bird watching. And suddenly my eyes were opened. And that's what I love about Bird Fair, is there were so many different facets to it that you could turn to. There were events, there were writers, there were conservationists, there were scientists, there were binoculars, there were telescopes, everything to do with the bird world. I found it quite overpowering, I guess, in a way. But once I understood that this was such a great community, I loved it and I embraced it. So I suppose it leads to the question. And I suppose these are all tied up together, because you then retired from Rutland Water, and then the Bird Fair ceased to be not long ago. Why did these two things happen? Is it a shame? And how do you move forward?
Well, obviously, it was a massive blow when I heard that the local organisation had decided to pull the Bird Fair. And I was immediately inundated with requests from around, literally from around the world. What are you going to do about it, Tim? And I thought, well, actually, I'm doing global birding. I'm doing a little bit, and I'm meant to be retired, and I'm heading towards my 80s, sadly. But I thought, well, when you think about it, and I thought, well, first of all, you know, why are they doing this? You know, what possible reason would you want to pull such a successful event? The COVID obviously didn't help, because they didn't hold a proper bird fair for a couple of years. But it didn't help, and I can be quite fair, I think, to say that a new CEO for the Wildlife Trust came in, and I think he thought perhaps, you know, he could do this. You know, he was much younger. He did actually offer me a consultancy to actually run the fair, but he did say, you can't make any decisions, you can't actually really do anything, but we'd love you to keep all your friends and networking done. But I thought, well, you know, if he's that good, then, you know, let him get on with it and do it, and, you know, I will support it in any way I can, but I won't actually be involved in the day-to-day running of it. They then held a virtual bird fair, which was unbelievably unsuccessful. Again, I think it was the early days of virtual, things, so that wasn't really very good. And then things changed, and I think, you know, personnel changed, and they decided to pull it. I think it's very sad for Rutland Water. And that put a lot of pressure back on me, because, you know, when you set up something that has been so successful for, you know, as you say, inspiring people for all sorts of different reasons. Penny and I sat back in early January, and said, look, you know, could we actually do this? Could we actually run another bird fair? We'd love the idea that our global birding was being so successful. So I said, oh, I'll tell you what we do. We'll have global birding brings you global bird fair. That sounded actually quite nice to us. But we thought, well, that's a huge amount of work for two people to take on. And where on earth are we going to hold it? The trusts are saying, no, you definitely can't hold it on our nature reserve anymore. So I looked around the areas. I looked at perhaps other sites around the reservoir. They weren't really very suitable. And then I thought of the Rutland Showground. And, of course, they were absolutely over the moon. They loved the idea of holding it there. So we went and had a look. We looked at the logistics of it all. I contacted the various contractors that we'd used in the past, and they said, oh, please, 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 you know, we'd love to, you know, come back. So that really sort of set us upon a route to see whether or not, you know, it would work or not. But the next thing, of course, was to contact all the people that had taken part. So we sent out an email to about 300 people or 300 organisations, NGOs and individuals to see whether they felt there would be any interest in attending. Within hours, I think we had about 200 say, yes, please, we want the bird fair back again. And we thought, oh, God, what have we let ourselves in for? I was expecting, yeah, no, we don't want to do this. We're far too busy doing other things. But I'm absolutely over the moon that they did, of course, come back. And so about 3 weeks later, we made it public that we were going to launch the bird fair as a new event called Global Bird Fair. At a new location, very nice location. We started talking to other people like the hoteliers and Discover Rutland and places like that. And they said, wow, this would be just amazing. Because what people don't probably always think about is what it generates for the local economy. And we know it's around about £1.4 million, you know, that whole weekend. This is quite extraordinary. So, I mean, they were over this very, very supportive. And then, of course, you had to think about, well, in the past, I've done it through a charity. We've done it as just part of my work, you know. So I had to set up a new company. I had to set up all the VAT, insurance, all that sort of stuff, which, again, I've never really had to deal with. So a whole learning curve was coming my way. I think, well, it's just talking to exhibitors. I've got to do all this. Again, Penny's been absolutely amazing. So, yeah, it's up. It's running. What are we now? Sort of 2.5 months in, we've got 150 exhibitors already booked up and more coming in each day, new sponsors coming in. And it's going to be brilliant. It's going to be on the 15th, 16th, 17th of July. And we'd just love to see lots and lots of people coming.
Do you think also, now that we're out of COVID and we've got more people possibly engaged with nature and conservation, are you making a concerted effort to, because the one thing that people used to say about Bird Fair was it was the same people, it was the same demographic. Are you trying to appeal to younger people, to different people than you normally did? What are you trying to do to make this feel as though we are in a different time now?
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, it will feel like the old bird fair, in the sense that the exhibitors are going to be virtually the same. You know, there are new ones coming in, there's new NGOs. As we get people like the David Shepherd Art coming in, we've got WWF coming in for the first time, we've got the Woodland Trust, we've got lots of new NGOs coming in. There will be the travel side of it, inevitably. You know, I want them to be there. So nowadays, with the travel companies particularly, they're under the new regulations, the packet travel regulations, which are really, really important for the customer as well as ensuring that, you know, the company is absolutely totally sustainable. And we will be concentrating very much on trying to get more and more young people there. We're looking at doing an equivalent of a university challenge type event. We're encouraging the young ambassadors of the different optical companies and with the different NGOs who have, you know, like the Wildfire Trust and people like that, you know, who will be bringing younger people through. We're working with as many smaller communities as possible. Wonderful thing about, of course, social media is that particularly things like Instagram, you know, we are getting a lot of new people engaging in that. You know, inevitably the first year is going to be you know, suck it and see how it goes on, you know, whether is it going to be successful or not. Everything at the moment points to it's going to be successful. The advanced booking sales for tickets have just gone through the roof. I'm quite incredible. You know, we're 4 months away and still, you know, hundreds of people are applying to come. And we know a lot of these are new people. We're engaging with a lot of new volunteers. Again, of a certain age, we have to accept that because a lot of people can't actually, you know, take the time off, you know, in the midweek to come and build stands and do all this sort of thing. So, you know, we will be similar, but we will be different, without a doubt. You know, we're looking at the types of lectures more carefully and making sure that, you know, there's more engagement with different interests from the natural world. We're trying to get as many young authors coming in to do to talk. So, yeah, we're very hopeful this will be, you know, a different feel. A different location also makes a big difference.
And hopefully there might even be a Gonservation conversation or two to be had.
Well, I'd be surprised if there wasn't. And it'd be up to you, young man, to sort that out.
I'd better start wrapping this interview up and get working on it. All right, well lastly, I'd like to just ask you, with so much more interest now involved from people about conservation, what advice can you give people? Because sometimes it's too daunting a subject, but there's something that everybody can do, say in their own lives. How would you advise people to do something that helps?
Well, where on earth do you start? Do you eat less meat? Do you not throw away so much waste food? Do you turn the heater down? And, you know, look carefully at how you live your life. And, you know, by doing even three of those things, it can do an awful lot for nature. But if you want to actually go out and really engage with nature, then there are lots of different ways you can do that. I mean, that you can volunteer for an organization, you can go out into your local community and perhaps set up a community group. You know, you don't have to be a big NGO. You can, I mean, here we are in the lovely little village of Alexton, in the heart of England, and you just told me about this group you've got in the village here. You've got a little bit of land that you're looking after, you're saving that, it's going to be, you know, wonderful for wildlife. Come on, tell me how many creatures you saw on your BioBlitz.
250 species, and it was raining the whole weekend, so we couldn't even pick up all the moths that we would have got.
So there you go. I mean, that's just a great opportunity. There's Kerry here, down in Alexton, you know, doing your bit for conservation at a local level. And think, you know, you're by the river, you're going to get little kingfishers going up there feeding, as you said, the moths, the insects, and that can be done all over the world in your own communities. So don't just feel you can, by going out and supporting, we hope you will do, the RSPB and places, you know, organisations like that, you can do your bit yourself. Go out and just take your friend out. If you're a keen wildlife enthusiast anyway, and your neighbour, you notice now, does occasionally look out of the window and wonder what things are, just take them out, you know, enjoy nature, but just take your time. Don't necessarily hurry, rush into things, because we are at a stage in our lives, I think, and the sake of the planet is we are in trouble. I think there's no two ways about it, but we as a loving community who want to help nature can do our bit at our level. You don't have to be a Peter Scott or a David Attenborough. I wish there were. You know, what's going to happen with David? I mean, he, again, is a major inspiration for me. And I think you'll know that I've had a long relationship with David Attenborough, along with my dear brother, who sadly, you know, from the days of the old grey whistle test, when David inspired Mike to take up the old grey whistle test when David was head of BBC Two. So, you know, people like this, where are the others? Are there people coming through that are going to be like these mentors? I hope there are, because we do need people to inspire. And one of the things that I've been very much aware of in the last probably 2 years is the number of young people that are coming through. There's a great organisation called the Instabirders. It's all just on on Instagram and that sort of stuff. But they're talking to each other. There's these ambassadors for the BTO. There's ambassadors here, you know, and they're all sort of... In fact, yesterday I was at the showground and a 12-year-old little girl came up with her mum, and she was freezing. She had a little top on. But then I noticed she had a badge, and it was an osprey. And she said, oh, yes, I'm an Osprey ambassador. I'm 12 years old, and I go out, and we go and talk to people in the bird-watching hide, and it's lovely. We just love it. And so this is a 12-year-old who will, I know will go on to become more than just an ambassador. She will be an amazing person. She's so enthusiastic. So what we're trying to do with the younger generation, and if you look at the number of courses that are offered now with the different universities, we just need to make sure that what I don't want to see is a 9-to-5 conservationist. And this is, I think, the problem a little bit is we need to get more people into the field, more experience, because you can learn so much from a book, but there's nothing better than actually getting your hands dirty. And I think that's a little bit of a problem in many ways, that people come out of university nowadays who just think, you know, wow, I've got it all, I can do this, I can do that, because it says that on page 65, you know, and I've got my degree and I've done this. We need people in the field. And that's really where I think the strength of conservation lies in the future.
So there you go. The advice is, Tim Appleton says, get your hands dirty.
Absolutely.
Tim, this time with you has absolutely flown by. It's been utterly fantastic. I'm sure we could do this for hours and hours, but we do have to go. So I'd just like to say thank you very much for joining me today. You are Tim Appleton, a conservationist. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been the greatest pleasure. I mean, just wonderful to see you again and to know what you're doing for conservation through conservation is quite extraordinary. And I look forward to seeing you on the stage on the 15th or the 16th of July or even the 17th, you know, who knows? See you in July. And many thanks to everybody for listening to me today.
Thank you, Tim. Conservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about conservation and conservation conversations at conservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at conservation. Conservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.